Go ahead, if you will, and turn back over to Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, we'll be looking at this passage here in just a minute. Several weeks ago, I was listening to the news or reading the news, one of the two, and came across an account of where our government stimulus money is being used to refurbish an historically significant lifeguard stand. I know you as I rest better at night knowing that our tax money is helping to do that. But what really struck me as interesting about this was the fact that the reason that it was costing so much was that the government was requiring that a chairlift be placed on this lifeguard stand. In other words, the people who started it actually had a much more modest budget in mind, but the government came along and said, you've got to add this so that those who are disabled can use it. While that might not be the best use of our money, I will say that it does say something about our government. Over the past several years, the U.S. government has tried to make it where those with disabilities do not have to suffer, at least immensely in some ways because of them. Going all the way back to the Americans with Disabilities Act several years ago, the government put in place things that would help those. And so you go into a hotel now and you'll see the numbers beside the doors, but you'll also see Braille. And you go into a building where there's stairs and you'll find an elevator there. The government has tried to help those. But for all of the good that our government has tried to do, there's one thing they cannot do. And that's heal those with disabilities. That was not the case with Jesus Christ. Jesus did not come to earth to heal people. That was not His mission. He did not come to find those with problems and to heal them and to spend all of His days here on earth doing that. But yet when He had opportunity, He did so. And oftentimes He would do this in order to bolster belief in the message that He was bringing. Sometimes we read about these healings so often that we almost look at them in kind of a ho-hum fashion, don't we? You know, we read about Jesus or the apostles, and they healed leprosy, and they cured blindness, and they gave hearing to the deaf, and they raised the dead, as though that were just common, ordinary things. Well, obviously that was not the case. Each and every one of the healings that we have described in the Bible is a very amazing act of the power of God. When we come to Acts chapter 8, though, I think we come to one of the most unusual of these healings. And it's been read this morning. This man is brought out. He's blind. Jesus comes to him, does something a bit unusual here. He spit on his hands and laid his hands on his eyes, verse 23 tells us, or on him, and asked him, "Do you see anything?" And the man said, verse 24, "I see men, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. This particular healing has given commentators a very great amount of grief. You go to several different books, and you read about this, and you'll have some commentators who take the idea of, well, this man just did not have the faith that he needed at that point to be healed. I'm a little uncomfortable with that view. Because Jesus Christ never depended on the faith of someone else in order for His miracles to work. Now, Jesus may have required faith on some occasions, but never was that kind of the fuel behind Jesus' miracle. Because He only had a little bit of faith, the miracle could only partially be worked. But as the man's faith grew, then he could say, I don't believe we find that as being the case. This morning, I'm not going to stand before you and tell you that I have the answer to that. But I'm going to tell you I have a hunch. And I believe that we find the answer, perhaps, to this by looking not only at the miracle itself, but by looking at the surrounding passages to this miracle. While this blind man had his physical sight restored, I believe at least one purpose of this miracle was to help to restore some spiritual sight to some men very close to Jesus who needed to have their eyes opened. This morning, I want us to talk about that. Not only did this blind man now see, but I believe we'll find the sight of the apostles being opened as well. Let's back up, if we will, to a little bit of a previous section in this chapter. If you look back to the first part of chapter 8, verses 1 down through 10 is one of the accounts of Jesus feeding the 4,000. And we won't take time to read that this morning, but you'll recall that Jesus took a very small portion of food and he spread it a very long way with stuff even left over. And so after this very great miracle that takes place, Jesus then is confronted by the Pharisees. And if you look down to verse 11, it says, "The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and he said, 'Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation.' And he left them, got into the boat again, and went to the other side." So here are the Pharisees, no real concern about understanding Jesus, no real concern about accepting his message, but rather finding the opportunity to challenge him in some way, seeking to find the opportunity to diminish what he has to say. And so Jesus then talks to his apostles in verse 14. He says, "Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, 'Watch out! Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod.'" Could you tell what was on Jesus' mind? Here he had performed this great miracle, these crowds following after him, seeking the truth. And then the Pharisees come along and they're questioning and they're testing and they're diminishing. And so as all of this is playing on Jesus' mind, he takes the opportunity at hand to talk to his apostles. And he says, "You better be careful. They're out to destroy you. They're out to take the faith away from you that will save you." And then we find the apostles with very blurry vision. The apostles, who should have understood what Jesus was talking about, very concerned about something else. Look down to verse 16. It says, "They began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, 'Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?' And they said to him, 12. And to the seven for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, 'Do you not yet understand?'" Here Jesus knew that there were things afoot that could destroy their souls. Here were things that could take the very spiritual life away from them. And what were they discussing? What are we going to eat? What were they discussing? "We didn't bring enough bread with us." And Jesus says, "Have you forgotten already? Do you not remember when I took very small portions and fed 4,000 people and small portions and fed 5,000 people and you're worried about what you're going to eat?" I imagine it was with a very sheepish expression. They had to answer, 12 baskets full. 7 baskets full. Jesus was telling them, "You're blurry in your vision of me. Your spiritual eyes have only been partially opened." And he ends that discussion in verse 21 by asking again, "Do you not yet understand?" Well, following this occasion is the passage that we read. Verses 22 down through verses 26 tell us about this man that they come to who is blind. And Jesus performs a miracle and his eyes are partially open. And Jesus performs another miracle and he's given full vision. And then following that miracle, we have another occasion with the apostles. It was after this discussion that the disciples went to the second part, I believe, in their own spirituality of this healing. And so what we find is that Jesus is going to sharpen their focus on what's going on. Look down to verse 27. Jesus went on with His disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, He asked His disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told Him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered Him, "You are the Christ." It's interesting that at this point, Jesus lays the question at their doorstep. He says, now I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but He says, "You've been with Me all of this time. You have seen all of these miracles that I've performed. You've watched as I've fed 5,000. You've watched as I've fed 4,000. You've watched the eyes of the blind open and countless other miracles. Who do those around you say that I am? John the Baptist? Elijah? One of the prophets who's returned?" Jesus, however, was unwilling to leave the conversation there. He then turns to His apostles and He says, "But who do you say that I am?" In other words, it's time to hear just how open your eyes are. And with clarity, Peter responds with the only acceptable answer: "You are the Christ." And I believe with that answer, there was an opening of the eyes. What before had been somewhat shady to them, the point that they could get in a boat with Jesus and as Jesus warned them about their souls, they're thinking about bread. Now we've come to the occasion where Jesus is saying, "You understand who I am." Now, does that mean that there won't be further problems? No, there will be. Will that mean that there's no other times when there will be some confusion? We know that's not the case. But at this point, Peter confesses and testifies, "I clearly see who you are. No more seeing you as this blind man saw men as trees. I see you in your fullness." As we consider this section, and as we consider the spiritual blurriness being fine-tuned to understand who Christ is, I want to bring the lesson down to us. And I want us to evaluate our own spiritual vision. When you and I consider what we are as Christians, where do we stand right now? As we think about the blurry vision or the sharpened focus, where do we stand in our view of Jesus Christ? Let me begin by saying this. I think when people become Christians, that most everyone understands fully the black and white of Mark 16:16. And I'm talking about people who have truly been baptized for the remission of their sins. We know what Mark 16:16 says: "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. He who does not believe shall be condemned." And when someone comes forward and makes that confession and is baptized, I believe that there is an understanding of that. That without baptism, there is no salvation. Without baptism, there is no hope of heaven. In the very black and white terms that Christ gives, we understand that. The question that I have for us this morning is, do we understand what comes after that? Do we clearly in our minds understand what it means to be a disciple of the Lord? Those 12 men who were chosen came from various backgrounds. And it was a growing process for them, not just to understand who Jesus was, but to understand what was involved in being a follower of His. Understanding what it meant to be His disciple. They had a very difficult time transforming their vision from the mundane to the spiritual. They had a very difficult time taking themselves from below the sun thinking, as Solomon would tell us, to thinking above the sun. And if you're like me, you can sympathize. And not only can you sympathize, you can empathize with that. Because I'm afraid a lot of times in my own life, I have that same problem of learning to take my discipleship to the next level that it needs to be. Let's consider the example at hand with the apostles. They were worried about what they were going to eat. The disciples worried about the physical bread instead of the words of the Lord. They were concerned that they had not brought enough and somehow this would upset their master without understanding what the Lord had in mind for them. That strikes at the very heart of what the Lord taught. Look back with me, if you will, to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, and we're going to look to verse 25 to begin with. And listen to this part of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus is giving not suggestions, not good things that we might want to think about, but commands for our life. And I believe sometimes we forget that this is a command in verse 25 when He says, "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on, is not life more than food, and is the body not more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field and how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I say even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will He not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore do not be anxious, saying, 'What shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear?'" Jesus tells His listeners, who would have been a very poor group of people, incidentally, don't worry where your next meal is coming from. Don't worry where you're going to get your clothes. These things are what the pagans are worried about, and you are not pagans any longer. These are the things that God provides for His own. And so maybe we look at these disciples and we kind of tisk at them a little bit. And we say, "You saw all of those signs and yet you could question whether the Lord could provide for you." Well, let me tell you something. We've seen those signs. Why are these things recorded for us in the Bible? It's not good stories to teach our kids, though they are good stories to teach our kids. It is to build our faith. And I'm afraid sometimes we act just like the apostles acted. Sometimes we're worried about those same kinds of things. We need to understand that God will provide. You ever let your imagination get away from you? You start worrying about things. All of a sudden you're 95 years old, sitting on the corner selling pencils to try to get enough to buy your next meal. We do that, don't we? We start thinking, "Well, if I lose my job, what's going to happen? If I don't have a check coming in, what's going to happen? What if my company folds? What if..." And before too long, we what if ourselves into a state of panic, as though God has never made a promise to us. As though God has never said to us, "I take care of my own. Trust me." And like the apostles, we're worried about where our next meal comes from. Sometimes misery loves company, doesn't it? So I would say to us, maybe we've got some good company here. Men even as great as Moses worried about this problem. I want us to look back to Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Where Moses, he thought, had been given a very tall order. Here God had talked about how He was going to take care and feed the people. And we look down to verse 21. Of Numbers chapter 11, and we find Moses' response. It says, but Moses said, the people among whom I am numbered, 600,000 on foot, and you have said, I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them? And I love the response of the Lord. Verse 23, the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Moses, do you not remember that I made Egypt into a ghost town? Moses, do you not remember I parted the Red Sea? Moses, do you not remember that I've given you victory? And yet you somehow question, where am I going to get all of this? It didn't take Moses long to come back to his senses. It didn't take him long to realize that no, the Lord's hand is not shortened. And like Moses and like the apostles, our spiritual clarity comes when we trust that God will provide the necessities that we need. Is worrying a temptation? Absolutely it is. And there are times when things look very frightful for us. But God has said, I will provide. Let's take this one more step. I think sometimes as well, like the apostles, we have difficulty transforming our views from secular to spiritual. They had a hard time getting over the things of this earth. And I believe we do as well. But yet we think about the statement that we've made. Because like Peter, those of us who are Christians have made the exact same confession. Do you remember that time in your own life? Whether that was 2 weeks ago or whether that was 20 years ago or maybe 60 years ago. When perhaps before a congregation of the Lord's people or maybe before your family who was gathered together or maybe just you and a preacher, you were asked, do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, the Christ? And you said yes to that statement. Upon that confession, everything changes. Upon the confession of saying, I believe that Jesus is the Christ, and buried in baptism to have our sins forgiven, everything in our life changes. Because you see, spirituality, it's not like our Sunday go to meeting clothes, are they? We don't take them out on Sunday morning, all neatly pressed, put them on, wear them a little while, and then fold them, put them back. When we become a Christian, that is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 and one quarter days a year, until God calls us home. And what we must do during that time is understand everything changes. Look over to Colossians chapter 3 with me. Colossians chapter 3. As we look down to verses 1 through 4, listen to what Paul says. He says, beginning in verse 1, if then you have been raised with Christ, seek things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you shall also appear with Him in glory. You ever just sat back and thought about that? When Christ, who is your life, I would suggest to you this morning that for a Christian, there is no separating the secular from the spiritual. That for a Christian, everything is spiritual. Let me just pause here and say, I know there are some who might leap on these words and say, well, that means that the Lord's people can do whatever they want to as a congregation. No, God's given us restrictions and rules on that. What I'm talking about is each of us as individuals before our Lord. Everything is spiritual. Consider with me, still here in the book of Colossians, over to chapter 3. And I believe we find a passage very close here that makes our point. Verse 18, wives, submit to your husbands, what? As is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily for the Lord and not for men. You ever just sat back and evaluated your life based on that? Husbands and wives? You ever thought about that? That relationship that you have, the words that you speak to each other, the things you do for each other or don't do for each other, that's a part of your Christianity? Young people, have you ever thought when your parents say to you, be home at 10, and you want to be home at 12, and you say, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and you don't bicker and fight back, that's a part of your Christianity? Have we ever thought about with our employers when they're piling work on us and maybe not treating us the way we want to, and we return that with a yes, sir, or a yes, ma'am, and we do our work, that's a part of our Christianity? There is no secular for the Christian. Whether we're talking about the fair way, or the freeway, or the school, or the place of employment, or the grocery store, or the gas station, wherever we are, our light is to be shining before men. And when we understand that, we're going to glorify God. And might I also say that it's got to shine here as well. In the work that we do collectively as a congregation, the work that we do, that we are to act in such a way that with every ounce of our being, we're saying that we love the Lord. Sometimes I wonder when I hear someone questioning and say, now, where in the Bible can you show me that Sunday night and Wednesday night are required? Like it. There's no place in the Bible that says thou shalt come to church on Sunday night and Wednesday night, if that's the black and white that someone's looking for. But now I ask, for the person who has transformed his sight from secular to spiritual, where else would you rather be? Is there something better that you could be doing? Is the TV program? Is the ball game? Is the activity? Is the walk in the park? Whatever. Is that more important than the next step in transforming the secular to the spiritual? For all of us, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, our focus must be on the glorification of God. And every action, every thought, every word has got to be made captive to the glory of God. And I'm going to tell you something, that's not an easy job to do. Frank mentioned in the class this morning how faith is work. You know, it's not something that just automatically happens to you. It's not something that you're just going to be sitting there and one day you're going to be this faithful person you've always wanted to be. It's work every day. Getting up and saying, I want to be closer to God than I was yesterday. Every day saying, if the Lord returns today, I want to be welcomed home as His faithful servant. So many times we can do the short-term stuff very, very well. But for the long term, the day in, the day out, that's where our struggles multiply. Let's let the Lord encourage each of us as He encouraged His apostles to understand, to let the blurriness be lifted, and to allow ourselves to see clearly. And so I ask each of us, does the blind man's healing have an impact on us? Are we people who are spiritually blurry in our vision? Well, if that's the case, like the blind man, Jesus will open our eyes so that we can see Him for who He truly is. This morning, let's let the Lord admonish each of us to do better, to go out and to open our eyes and to see what He wants us to be, because He'll guide us every step of the way.